Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. This is the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. If you didn't hear about the Internet Privacy Protection Bill in the media until late last week, you're not alone. On Tuesday, almost every House Republican voted to undo rules that require Internet providers like Comcast or AT&T to ask for your permission before they sell your information. Last week, the Senate approved the bill on a party line vote. It's now on Donald Trump's desk, and he is expected to sign it. So why didn't this get more attention? Well, there were no committee hearings or debates on this and many other issues. So what else are we missing because of this and because of so much attention on Donald Trump's tweets, the allegations about Russia's involvement in the 2016 presidential election, and the contacts between Trump's team and Moscow? Every day, there seems to be a new twist in that story. We haven't really covered it because so many stories are either based on speculation or unverified sources. But we are going to talk about it today. What do we know and what don't we know? And how should reporters tackle this issue? Joining us are three guests. Craig Aaron is president of Free Press, an independent organization that fights to save the free and open Internet, curb runaway media consolidation, and ensure diverse voices are represented in the media. Hi, Craig. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Nice to have you back. Jonathan Lande is a veteran war correspondent and a national security correspondent for Reuters. For many years, Jonathan covered national security for McClatchy Newspapers. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter Stone is a veteran journalist who covers money and politics, lobbying, and the law. Since late last year, Peter has been covering Russia for McClatchy Newspapers, which include the Sacramento Bee. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be on with you.
Great to have all of you. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off by highlighting journalism that stood out this week. So, Peter Stone, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, there were several stories in the Russia beat that were really quite excellent. If I can praise some colleagues, I'm sure everybody likes to do that.
Sure.
I would start with stories that both AP broke and NBC broke regarding the Trump and Russia ties and the Russia influence probe that's been going on. NBC had a couple of terrific stories earlier this week, including one where they looked at his Manafort, who we've also written about at McClatchy yesterday, but they dug into some records on his home acquisitions and found that he paid cash for a number of these homes, and also discussed concerns that were growing about possible money laundering involving some of these home purchases. We'd been digging into that at McClatchy as well and did a follow-up with some other work on that subject just yesterday. AP also had some great stories, including the one that I think got the most attention, and that is about a earlier contract involving Manafort, and who was, of course, Trump's campaign chairman at a critical time last year, and it's one of the key figures who's under investigation. The AP story basically looked at his earlier work, Manafort's earlier work, for Oleg Deripaska, who is a very close ally of Putin, a very wealthy oligarch in Russia, and they found that he had a contract with Deripaska that started in 2006 and ran for at least a few years for $10 million a year. There was also a suggestion that some of this effort might have been done to boost the Putin government, which both Deripaska and Manafort vehemently denied. So those are two stories that I think were really noteworthy just in the last week.
So two stories from the AP and NBC. And again, just to remind listeners, because it seems like there's something new happening every day, and it's incredibly difficult to follow this story. As you have reported, Peter, Paul Manafort is the man who headed Donald Trump's presidential campaign last summer, and you report that at issue is whether he needed to register as a foreign agent on behalf of Ukraine or Russia and failed to do so. And so we're going to talk more extensively about that later in the show. And that is Peter Stone. Since late last year, he has been covering Russia for McClatchy Newspapers, which includes the Sacramento Bee. And what about you, Jonathan Lande? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought there was a story, I think it was the New York Times, and I apologize for not getting this absolutely correct, but what I found absolutely fascinating was the report of that Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, met with the president of a Russian bank that is under U.S. sanctions. A Russian bank, the initials VEB, whose chairman is a former Russian intelligence officer, and that has in fact been implicated in Russian espionage operations here in the United States. He's a Russian, but he was based in New York, pleaded guilty last year to working with the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. And that kind of went under the radar last year. But you have to ask the question, at a time when the Kushner's company was looking to get investors into a landmark New York City building, that he would be meeting with the head of a Russian bank that has ties to espionage, that whose chairman was an FSB officer. And we got to remember that you don't become head of a Russian bank without the approval of the Kremlin, specifically President Putin, and one that's under sanctions. And so for me, that was a really major story, and again raises the questions: what was he doing meeting with a bank that was under U.S. sanctions?
Jonathan, the New York Times covered this along with other outlets, and the Times is reporting that Senate investigators plan to question Kushner about these ties.
Indeed. I mean, he's apparently volunteered to go speak to the Senate Intelligence Committee, but they're not ready to speak to Jared Kushner yet. The chairman of that committee, I believe yesterday, said that they want to do more research into this issue before they ask Mr. Kushner to come up and speak to the committee.
All right, and that story is called Senate Committee to Question Jared Kushner Over Meetings with Russia. This is a New York Times story. And Jonathan has also been covering this issue, and we'll talk about that with Jonathan, who is a national security correspondent with Reuters, a little later in the show. And Craig Aaron, what about you? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I may have to switch gears a little bit. My week has been really consumed with broadband privacy, and there were a couple pieces that really jumped out to me. One to sort of transition from national security was a piece that Gizmodo did called "This Is Almost Certainly James Comey's Twitter Account," where a reporter there, Ashley Feinberg, overheard, or I guess he was on stage, the FBI director talking about his secret Twitter account that he uses, and she actually tracked it down, which in and of itself is kind of a stunt, but what I found fascinating about it was just how much she was able to glean with just a couple of pieces of information to be able to get all the way to this account that Comey had been using to sort of talk to friends and family and highlight some other things. So I thought that was a nifty piece of reporting, if not quite at the levels of international intrigue that the other folks have described. And similarly, I actually had a piece this morning that NPR ran on Morning Edition talking about how data is being used, and so-called alternative data is being used for things like credit checks, where, you know, now is it not only your credit score and these other already flawed and mysterious ways that you're being judged and scored, but increasingly lenders are using information like whether you go inside of a gas station to pay for your gas or pay at the pump, or whether you surf the internet late at night to determine if you are credit worthy and should be given loans and other things. This is some pretty harrowing stuff when you start to go down the rabbit hole.
Wow.
And figure out how this information is going to be used. So those were two pieces that really popped out to me of looking at the digital trails we're all leaving and how that information is going to be exploited.
And they know about this because we use credit cards now for everything and use our phones for so much now. I mean, they know whether we go in the gas station or pay at the pump because of our credit cards.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's that credit card information that tells you, and I guess the theory from talking to these data folks is that, hey, if you go into that gas station, you might be a smoker, and they think smokers are less credit worthy.
Wow.
So now, of course, you could have a lot of other reasons for going into a gas station. Maybe you were thirsty. Maybe any number of reasons. Maybe you don't like using your credit card out there at the pump because you're afraid that it's going to be skimmed. Who knows? But the fact is that these are coming in and being used in all kinds of things. Your ability to get a loan, your ability to get connected to various different kinds of services. A lot of these algorithms are being used to calculate bail and jail sentences. So, very quickly, all of this data and how it's put together and how these, generally pretty faceless and obscure institutions use them, that's all happening, and we're barely having a public conversation about it.
Barely. All right, so kudos to NPR for that story. That seems like a must listen for sure. And then Gizmodo will put the story about Comey's tweets at our website, yourcallradio.org. That's Craig Aaron. He is president of Free Press. You know, what we've been asking almost every Friday since the election, and I'd like to ask you all the same question, I think it's a real important one, is how are you all deciding where to focus? And when you have meetings with your editors, for example, and your colleagues, how do you decide where to focus? Because so much is happening so quickly. And even those of us who follow the news for a living and are news junkies and who spend late nights on the internet, we're having a hard time keeping up. So, Jonathan Landay, what is this conversation like at Reuters?
Well, I think the main point that we focus on right now is whether or not we're being purposely distracted from the main story, which is, was there, and this is what the focus of the investigations are, was there collusion between any members of the Trump campaign or Trump advocates during the campaign and Russia, and so you have the release of what we jokingly call there goes another silver squirrel. Watch the silver squirrel. And meanwhile, something else, we're being distracted from something even more important. And you raised a very good example in your intro, which was the passage of the internet data bill, that suddenly found its way to the president's desk while everybody was focused on other things. And I should say, at the same time that that was happening, let's not forget, he was signing an executive order to basically do away with the guts of President Obama's climate change agenda.
Yep.
And so people kind of distracted from that too. And then this morning, you see another tweet from the president about a witch hunt, and that General Flynn should get immunity. And so we talk about these developments as in ways, is this something that we need to look at, or are we being distracted again from the main story? But you're right, there are so many different tangents to this story. Trying to figure out which ones to focus on are extremely difficult, because Reuters is well resourced, we actually have divided the subject matters up into people are looking at at financial questions, other people are looking at IT questions, cyber hacking questions, and then some people are looking at the developments in Washington and the investigations that are going on. And then we kind of overlap with each other as well. The field is, the different tangents are quite extensive, and figuring out which ones to focus on at any one time is a challenge.
And to add to what you just said about the climate change rules, Scott Pruitt, the head of the EPA, moved late on Wednesday, I'm reading this piece from the New York Times, to reject the scientific conclusion of the EPA's own chemical safety experts who under the Obama administration recommended that one of the nation's most widely used pesticides be permanently banned at farms nationwide because of the harm it potentially causes children and farm workers. Some people said this is even more important than the climate rules, but this didn't get much attention. This happened like that. And then, Peter, last night, Vice President Mike Pence had to break a tie on a bill that has been sent to Trump's desk, giving states permission to withhold federal family planning funds from Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers. And a lot of people didn't see this coming. They thought Planned Parenthood was safe after the Republican health care repeal went down. But this happened so quickly, and a lot of pro-choice groups didn't even see this coming. So, Peter Stone, what are your thoughts on this? So much is happening that even groups that follow these issues closely don't see coming.
Well, I think there are two or three there are two or three different things at play here. I mean, I didn't follow the Planned Parenthood thing very closely, but I think I'm reading between the lines of what you just said now. I think with the defeat of health care, which was a huge blow to the Trump White House, to Republicans in Congress, they had made this a top priority for years now, ever since its passage, tried to block it when it came in, when it was passed. And this has been a mantra for the Republican Party. Don't forget that the House had passed repeal legislation dozens of times, I think over 50 during the Obama administration. Now you have a bill with the Trump in the White House that they try to rush through, rather ill-conceived, and they didn't do their homework, they didn't get enough support, and they had a very, very conservative caucus, the Freedom Caucus, blocking, you know, key parts of this. My guess is that the Planned Parenthood, and again, I'm just reading between the lines, was done as kind of a way of appeasing some of the base who were, you know, stunned by and disappointed by the defeat of the health care bill. I mean, you know, that sounds, from what you described, as probably the reason they tried to push this through quickly. Mm. I think they're scrambling to find victories to sort of rally the base again, to get Trump's approval rating back up, and to try to shift the topic a bit. There is an enormous problem about, paying attention in Washington. And while I think the Trump Russia story is a huge story, and the Russian influence in the election is a huge story, I certainly think that what is being done to environmental regulations is likewise a major story. We could see it coming during the campaign, in Trump's rhetoric, in his support. And that also is part of another story that's very large. It's part of the story about the almost the denigration of science, putting science advice, putting real science on the back burner, and going with ideology, and financial interests, who have, you know, together targeted climate change for some time. There was an interesting story just yesterday that speaks to this issue about science, and that is, I think it was the New York Times did a short piece about the number of vacancies in a key science office in the White House, where they have one remaining person in an office that's supposed to have about two dozen people. I mean, a lot of the people who are upset about what's happened to climate change see that as part of a bigger story where the White House is just doesn't believe in the science. And as you probably know, there's going to be a rally in Washington on Earth Day, and I think there's a science event that is going to be part of that or parallel that, postponed from a couple weeks ago, that's going to be taking place then as well. If you want me to go back to Russia a bit, I mean, there's lots to cover there. We can go into that now or hold it for, you know, our little later discussion. But there are clearly multiple issues there, as Jonathan said. There's the issue of what's going on in Congress, where you have two great stories. You have the Senate beginning, at least two great stories. You have the Senate beginning what appear to be some very serious hearings based on what was held yesterday, where some new evidence started came out about the scope of the Russia influence effort during the election. I think the most fascinating thing yesterday, or one of the most fascinating things, was the report that these influence efforts began during the primaries, and they seem to have targeted other people, including Rubio. Hmm. So the timeline on this influence effort has expanded, and new information about Russian trolls came out in the hearings yesterday. I'm not focused primarily on that, but it's something that everybody needs to watch because I think we'll learn a lot from them, and my reporting and other reporting will be infused by and capitalized on that kind of material. The House is a separate story, which is turning into a bizarre tale, at times a fiasco, with the split between Nunes, who is doing, appears to be doing all he can to help the White House play down this story. He is supposed to be the chairman of the committee, and a lot of ethics concerns are being raised about the role he's playing. Schiff, I think, has been, very eloquent on, the big picture, what this issue is all about, and the clash between Schiff and Nunes, the top Democrat on the committee, and Nunes is going to be a story to keep watching. Those are just a few things.
And we'll talk more extensively about Russia after the break. But getting back to legislation, Craig Aaron, if you turn on the cable shows, it's Russia almost consistently. And so that's one reason why we're not learning about a lot of this legislation. But isn't the other reason? It's because there are no committee hearings, no debates. And usually that takes time. It allows the public to know what's going on so they can actually express their views. Is that what happened with these privacy rules? Is that why we did not hear about them until pretty much after the Senate voted on them?
Yeah, I think that, Rose, I think that really is a big part of it, that a lot of the normal processes and procedures, I mean, usually Congress moving on something is this glacial process, sausage making, that takes forever. But the onslaught that's come, against so much of what happened late in the Obama administration, I mean, this sort of obscure procedural maneuver, the Congressional Review Act, which was used to overturn the broadband privacy protections, has also been used on, I think, 14 other rules from the Obama administration that we're also largely not talking about, but stream protections and labor regulations and, whether you should be able to shoot, baby bears from helicopters. I mean, it's a whole range of things that have been just rushed through the Congress on this aggressive timetable. And I think, the public can't keep up, and journalists themselves increasingly are just overwhelmed by the number of things happening. I mean, you look up and you think, oh, can we even still talk about this? I feel like it happened 3 years ago, and it turns out it was 2 weeks ago,
right?
Because there have been so many stories, and we're only in day 70 of this administration. And so with something like broadband privacy, there was some talk, they were maybe going to do it, and all of a sudden it's rushing to the floor. It's right in the middle of the healthcare debate, so most of the press corps is distracted, and it's a pretty obscure issue anyway. But then as soon as the Senate votes it through, all of a sudden everyone's like, wait, what happened? How did that happen when no one was watching? And there was this upsurge of media attention and upsurge of public outrage, which actually zeroed in on this in a way that those of us who've been advocating and trying to get attention on this story never expected. And in fact, among the folks who noticed that were the Republicans in Congress, who kept moving up the vote. And so it only actually had 48 hours in the House. So no subcommittee hearing, no committee hearing, straight through the Rules Committee to the floor and voted out in 48 hours. 20,000 people called in opposition during those 48 hours, which is very exciting. But the fact is that, members of Congress really didn't have a chance to digest this legislation, let alone there actually being any kind of public debate on it. And, that's the issue that I know the best and the one that I work on, but you can pick 15 other issues and probably 50 other issues that serious damage has been done, taking away public protections, doing special favors for industry, and these stories are completely, going under the radar.
And it's interesting that the Senate voted on this before the House. Senator Jeff Flake picked up on this privacy bill, and then Mitch McConnell jumped in, and that's when things moved very quickly. According to reports, Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell received about $251,000 from the telecom industry, including AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is sort of the one of the, I mean, it's a partly told story. I mean, there are reporters, Eric Lipson in the New York Times, others who have been on this story. You know, I know Peter Stone has covered the lobbying industry for a long time in Washington. You know, none of them expected to be in this situation of the Trump administration and Republican control of Congress, all the branches of government under one political party. And the way that lobbyists are operating in Washington right now is they don't know how long this is going to last. They don't know what's going to come out of the Russian investigations that folks are doing, but they're going to get theirs while they can. And so there is an unbelievably aggressive push across industries, you know, from day one here to dismantle, you know, not unlike what Steve Bannon's talked about, dismantle the regulatory state as much as they can. And that's what we're seeing on issue after issue after issue. And you see when it comes to the media and telecom industry, the phone and the cable companies, these are really influential, powerful, big spenders in Washington, and they were able to get the Senate and the House to prioritize the gutting of privacy protections, even in the middle of everything that else is going on, all these investigations, Supreme Court nominations, and on and on and on. They still found time on the calendar to do away with people's personal privacy.
We're going to have to do a show about this, but the overall gist is that now companies like internet providers, specifically like Comcast and AT&T, can sell your personal information without your permission.
Yeah, that's the basic idea, and their rules just passed in the fall to really limit this, and now what Congress has done is given the green light to these companies to say, yep, you can snoop on your own customers, sell it to whoever you want, and as we know, our web browsing histories tell people everything about who we are, our personal medical information, financial information, sexual orientation, religious and political affiliations. This can all be easily pieced together, and your ISP knows you better than anyone because they have to know to connect you to the sites and services you want to use.
And Craig, before we let you go, when is net neutrality going to be picked up?
It is coming really, really soon. You know, just yesterday, Sean Spicer, in answering questions about this broadband privacy rule, gave a really strong hint that they're coming for net neutrality next. The FCC the new head of the FCC, Ajit Pai, has been an enemy of net neutrality, so we expect it to be a matter of weeks, maybe a couple of months, for really aggressive moves to come against net neutrality. All the signals are there. The Trump administration is telling us they want to do it, and if we've learned anything over this last 70 days, it's pay attention when they tell you they're going to try to do something.
Well, we're going to keep our eye on that one for sure. Craig Aaron is president of Free Press, an independent organization that fights to save the free and open internet. Craig, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break on today's Media Roundtable, we will be talking about coverage of Russia. What questions do you have? What do we know? What don't we know? Jonathan Landay is covering this for Reuters, and Peter Stone is covering this issue for McClatchy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is the day we speak with reporters about coverage of the week's news. We're going to talk now about ongoing coverage of the allegations about Russia's involvement in the 2016 presidential election. What do you think of the coverage? Are you having a hard time connecting the dots? We definitely are. What do we know at this point? What don't we know? Jonathan Landay is a veteran war correspondent and a national security correspondent for Reuters. For many years, he was at McClatchy Newspapers. And since late last year, Peter Stone has been covering Russia for McClatchy. And that includes the Sacramento Bee. All right, let's dive in and talk about this. As we said earlier in the show, things are moving so quickly at this point. Jonathan, what are you focusing on at this point? What are the facts so far?
The main question, as I said earlier, the main question that I think the committee, the Senate committee at any rate, because the House committee is just so discombobulated politically, is, was there collusion between any supporter surrogate or member of the Trump campaign and Russia? That seems to be a question that has for which there are broad reasons to examine, specifically because for instance, the Trump surrogate and supporter, he was outside the campaign, Roger Stone, and the heads up he got in advance, that he tweeted that about John Podesta's email that they were going to be leaked, that he himself has admitted being in touch with Gulcifer 2, one of the hackers is widely considered to be a hacking front for a Russian intelligence, and so those seem to be some serious questions. Again, I raised there's been this ongoing question as to whether or not there were any discussions between Trump campaign aides or surrogates and Russian entities about the possibility of lifting U.S. sanctions on Russia in return for we're not sure. That has been an ongoing question. And in fact, we know that at least tangentially that was a conversation or at least a subject of conversations former National Security Advisor Flynn, Michael Flynn, the former head of the DIA, had with the Russian ambassador here in Washington. You've got to look at why was Jared Kushner meeting with the head of a Russian bank that is under U.S. sanctions, that is definitely got links to the Russian intelligence services, both through its chairman, who's a former officer of the Russian intelligence services, and the fact that one of its officers based in New York was pleaded guilty last year to espionage. There's just so much that sort of focuses you into that subject that, you know, it's hard to focus on other things. And one of the things that we've done here at Reuters last week, we published the results of a deep dive that we did into ownership of condominiums in two Trump properties in Miami. We came up with a number of dozens of Russian owners who paid close to $100 million for their condominiums, and some of these owners have got, connections into the Russian government. So again, there are numerous subject areas to look at. That it's difficult to sort of remain focused on one, and that's why we've got three different efforts going on here.
Right, and Peter, what would you add to that? Because today's headline, for example, in the Washington Post, why Michael Flynn may be seeking immunity. He says he now will cooperate with the House investigation as long as he receives immunity. And there have been many stories, the New York Times reported, about Michael Flynn working last fall for Turkey. He got $500,000 from Turkey. And then the Huffington Post has a story called Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, Gun for Hire. He's been paid by Turkish money laundered through a Dutch company to lobby on behalf of the Turkish government. More than bad judgment, Flynn's conduct raises ethical questions and casts doubt on his suitability for public office.
Well, Flynn is one of a half a dozen or so key people who are under investigation. Most were part of the Trump campaign. Roger Stone, who was a confidant of Trump and has been a lobbyist for him going back to the late 80s on and off, is another person, and Jonathan's description of those tantalizing details we know about Roger Stone's remarks about WikiLeaks in August. I wrote about that and interviewed Stone for The Guardian. I've written a little bit about that at McClatchy, too. I mean, Stone has held out that, you know, he got this information from an intermediary. He's described the intermediary as a journalist. He told me he was a conservative journalist, but he's not willing to cough up the name of this person. I just saw a piece today that Michael Isikoff interviewed Stone and tried to grill him on this subject. And Stone said, well, that's one piece of information I'm not giving up. Who is your intermediary with WikiLeaks? Who is your mutual friend, as Stone has described him? So Stone is under scrutiny. Flynn is definitely under scrutiny. And the question, there are multiple questions about Flynn. The lobbying for Turkey, a key issue there is why he was not registered and why he was not registered as a foreign agent. There's a fascinating couple of pieces to that story, including the fact that he did register belatedly and not too long ago, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks ago, he registered belatedly. But he had gone to the Trump campaign, or someone close to him had gone to the Trump campaign and raised this issue, apparently, should he register? And the Trump lawyers sort of blew it off, or nobody seemed to think it was very important. If they had had a little foresight, they probably would have thought it was important and seen that if he's doing that kind of work, he should have been registered. But why he was doing that work when he was a top foreign policy advisor for Donald Trump is another question. It's a huge ethical question. And so Flynn is surrounded by and mired in a lot of ethical questions. His lawyer is being aggressive now in asking for immunity. I think what we're going to see, what seems to be happening, is that nobody's willing to give him immunity till they know more about what he knows and what he was actually involved with. Immunity may be granted to people if they're willing to provide significant details about what, you know, whether there was collusion, as Jonathan said. I mean, that is a really fundamental question, but there are others as well. And, you know, I think last night it was fascinating to see the early stories emerge about this quote-unquote plea offer, you know, that was made to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees and made to the FBI. I'd heard rumors early in the week, well, they first surfaced last weekend, actually, on a CNN show, that he might be in discussions about a plea deal, and a lot of reporters were chasing this all week long. But I'd heard that he was in discussions as well, and I wasn't able to confirm it. Tried to reach Mr. Flynn's lawyer a number of times, who did not return phone calls. But, you know, they finally announced it, or they, you know, Wall Street Journal had enough that they forced them to say that, yes, we're in discussions. But the key point is that they haven't given them enough detail to make this work worthwhile for the committees at this point. And I think it's going to take time. I think the Senate Intelligence Committee is going to proceed methodically. They say they have a list of about 20 witnesses they want to talk to. There's a long ways to go in these hearings, and I think they're off, you know, they're now looking like they're off to a pretty good start. So there'll be a lot to learn from those hearings as a public source on all of this. We too are just one other point at McClatchy, where I'm not the only one working on this. I want to make it clear, too, I'm working on the Russia influence probe story, not Russia per se. So, you know, there are 4 or 5 veteran reporters at McClatchy who I'm working with on this, and we've sort of divvying up the turf and cooperating, working together on different stories. I've been teaming up a lot with Greg Gordon, who's terrific, and Tim Johnson and Kevin Hall and David Goldstein are also part of the team.
Peter Stone has been covering Russia since late last year for McClatchy, and their newspapers include the Sacramento Bee. And Jonathan Landay is a veteran war correspondent and national security correspondent for Reuters. He's also been covering Russia. And if you have any questions or comments on this, it's just getting nonstop coverage, difficult to follow. There's so many pieces to this. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.com. Reason.org. Jonathan, I think the difficult part for someone who's reading this is you've got all these different pieces. So, for example, last month, the Daily Beast had a headline called Top Trump Aide Paul Manafort Lobbied for Saudis Against Embassy Move to Jerusalem. Donald Trump's top aide Paul Manafort once lobbied against moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, putting him at odds with a key pro-Israel position and his boss. And then last May, an alternate, there's a piece about how Manafort made millions from arms dealers, warlords, dictators, tycoons who've left trails of unrest and mayhem. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So as a reporter, how do you connect all of these dots?
Well, that's what investigative reporters do. It's kind of difficult, but then you have disclosures like you were just talking about Paul Manafort. Well, it was just recently disclosed that he was working secretly for a Russian billionaire, a guy by the name of Oleg Deripaska, who is a close Putin ally, and the question is, you know, that he was planning to, he proposed, at least the Associated Press got a hold of documents that show that he was, Mr. Manafort, had proposed a confidential strategy as early as 2005 to influence politics and business dealings and even news coverage within the United States, Europe, and the former Soviet republics in favor of Mr. Putin's government. And that was at a time when relations between the United States and Russia were growing slowly but increasingly more fraught. And apparently he did sign a contract for $10 million to work on this effort on behalf of Mr. Deripaska, with whom Mr. Manafort maintained a business relationship for quite a long time. So I mean, but this is just, again, you know, there are things that seem to connect in all of these. Obviously, Russia is one. You have because you had Mr. Manafort with his ties to Russia and pro-Russian politicians in Ukraine, who was working for a while. You know, who worked as the chairman of Mr. Trump's campaign. You have Mr. Trump himself, who has had, despite his denials, extensive dealings with Russian-connected people, Russians themselves, people who owned condos in his properties. And in Russia, it just seems to be that you have various other figures associated with the campaign who are either directly associated with Russia or have Russian connections. So Russia is the point. And so you take that as your fulcrum and you work from there. And again, as I said, there are so many different branches of this thing that you have to try and focus on several and leave the others to other reporters.
And why not more focus on, for example, Michael Flynn being paid $500,000 by Turkey or Paul Manafort lobbying for the Saudis? That alternate story is about Manafort's firm being hired to lobby on behalf of Nigeria and Kenya, lobbying on behalf of Saudi Arabia,
right?
The Philippine dictator. I mean, the list is very long.
Right. I mean, you know, you go where the money is, right?
Right.
And those are all very good stories. But again, somewhat away from the main focus or the main question involved in all of this. Again, I've said it several times, and that is, was there collusion between any member of the campaign staff, the Trump campaign staff, or his proxies, and Russian officials? I mean, you know, in terms of, was there collusion in terms of the timing of the release of the hacked emails from the DNC? We saw at the convention how a piece of the GOP the Republican platform was altered when it came to providing offensive weapons to Ukraine was taken out. So Russia does seem to be the main focus. Yes, the Turkish connection is something very important. It has been focused on to a great extent. We learned just a couple of days ago about this meeting in September between Mr. Flynn and several Turkish ministers, including their energy minister, who is the son-in-law of Turkish President Erdogan, and that definitely was is something that needs to be looked at because of Mr. Flynn's after the fact registration as a foreign agent, and the fact that it appears, according to at least James Woolsey, the former CIA director who was at this meeting in September, that they discussed the possibility of sending back secretly to Turkey the Turkish cleric who lives here, Gulen, to face charges in Turkey, where he is accused of fomenting the coup last year against Mr. Erdogan. These are definitely important stories, but again, somewhat tangential to the main story about Russia. Now, there are also, we now learn, the connection between Mr. Flynn and the Russian government, former General Flynn and the Russian government, appearing as he did at a dinner with President Putin on RT on Russia Today, so there are Russian connections there as well, and I don't think there appears to be little question that the Russians were in fact interfering deeply in the American election. And what's bothering U.S. officials right now is the fact that they're saying that Russia is also using these same so-called active measures, fake news, hacking of money to nationalist parties in Europe, where you have crucial elections coming up in Russia, in Germany, and there have been allegations that there was Russian backing for Brexit. There were allegations that Russia was interfering in other parts, in other elections in Europe as part of an overall strategy of dividing Europe from the United States, weakening NATO, and breaking up the EU.
Just to add to that, to amplify it just for a minute, you mentioned the other stories. Well, Manafort was known, and the other countries you mentioned where he worked are stories that go back to the 1980s. Many of the first stories about Manafort last year, I wrote one in The Guardian, The Post wrote about him, a lot of people wrote about him, I'm sure Reuters wrote about him. It noted that he had a long career as a foreign consultant where he'd earned vast amounts of money. His most recent activities go back almost a decade in the Ukraine, which was his chief source of income going back to 2005, where he worked both for pro-Russian oligarchs and then for Yanukovych, the strongman leader who was very close to Moscow, who was overthrown in early 2014. The trail, I think, does increasingly go back to Russian influence efforts, and once again, it's important to keep in mind that 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, 17 U.S. intelligence agencies agree that Russia did mount a major effort to influence the U.S. election. It was originally seen as an effort to sow discord, to create confusion. Like Hillary Clinton, and the campaign sort of evolved into one to help Donald Trump. That seems to be a consensus view of U.S. intelligence agencies. That's the big picture. And the parts of that are important are the hacking of the Democratic emails, both the DNC and Podesta's emails, and then this amazing disinformation campaign, active measures that was accompanying that. Many of the experts who testified before Congress have said that Russia has done this in the past, but the scale of it was much larger this time around. And as Jonathan said, it's going on now in some European countries, or similar efforts appear to be underway in Germany and France. Tried it in the Netherlands. Their far-right candidate, the nationalist candidate, who seemed to be the favorite of the Brexit types, did not win, but it's seen as a kind of a paradigm or a model that will be tried in a lot of other countries. And I think Comey's predicted, FBI Director Comey has predicted, that it's going to happen again here in the 2018 elections. And so there's a real urgency in trying to figure out what this is all about, how it was really done, because there are many unanswered questions besides the collusion question. There's a question about money. How much money was coming, how much Russian money was behind this? Who was, you know, we know that some of the trolls and the bots that helped amplify pro-Trump messages, anti-Clinton messages, we know that many of those were linked to the Russian intelligence services, but we don't know all the money that went into them. We don't know about the money that went into fake news. There are a lot of threads to look at here, but you know, there's overwhelming evidence that there was a major Russian influence effort, and the question is unraveling that and then piecing it together, basically.
And is it safe to assume that once these hearings get underway, this is going to become a massive story? And I just wonder what you both think. Well, we have about 30 seconds for each of you, but Masa Gessen, who spent most of her life in Moscow, who's a journalist who now lives in the United States, says, "I think we have things to protect, that the obsession with Russia isn't necessarily conducive to protecting. The thing we have to protect is politics." She says, "I'm not saying there shouldn't be an investigation, but it should not be the sole or even the main focus of people who are concerned with protecting democracy under Trump." Jonathan Landay, quick response.
We'll just have to see. I'm just not, you know, we're just not sure. I mean, definitely, I think we have to watch what happens now that we're aware that Mr. Flynn is looking for immunity. There are other people who are under investigation, and I think, you know, the Senate investigation is going to be the serious one to keep an eye on. I'm just afraid that the one in the House is just kind of just too embroiled in politics now.
And when is that going to kick off?
Well, the Senate one has already started. We had their first hearing yesterday.
Right.
They are documents that they have been looking at from the intelligence community. They're sorting out how they're actually going to get access to these documents, because remember what happened the last time there was a Senate intelligence investigation, committee investigation that had to do with the torture report, and there was a big controversy over the fact that their computers were being accessed by the CIA. But that one is the serious one to look. It's already underway. It could take months. It's going to take months. And I wouldn't look for any quick resolutions.
Jonathan Landay is a national security correspondent with Reuters, and Peter Stone has been covering Russia for McClatchy Newspapers. Peter and Jonathan, thank you both for joining us.
Yes.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for joining us.